Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Legacy of Secrets by Jean Reinhardt, narrated by Michael Healy. Your hunger for rectitude blossoms into rage. The hot tears of mourning never shed for you, before your twisted measurements, the agony of denial, the power of unshared secrets. From the poem Inheritance, His, by Audre Lorde. Chapter 1. No good will come of this, Patrick said to his companions. I'm not here to take part in a riot. This was supposed to be a peaceful rally. Two of the men agreed with him, and the trio turned their backs to the impassioned speaker, John De Morgan, a radical agitator with Marxist views. He was standing on the steps of the Market Cross in Stockton, dodging missiles as he delivered his speech to thousands of people. To make matters worse, a number of unruly local youths had pushed their way into the crowd, inviting trouble. Used to the hard physical labor of quarry work, Patrick and his companions were broad-shouldered men, well able to cut a path through the heaving mass packed tight around them. Some pushing and shoving had broken out at random among the crowd, and a loud hissing and booing could be heard as the Stockton police made their presence known. Reinforcements had been sent for by telegram, and when the officers from Middlesbrough arrived, they had their cutlasses drawn. By the time Patrick and his companions had forced their way from the center of the crowd, sporadic fighting was taking place between some of the marchers and those who were antagonistic towards them and their cause. As the speeches were brought to an abrupt end, the crowd began to move towards the Victorian Bridge, spilling over into South Stockton, where even more rioting took place. Patrick could see a man in the distance on horseback who appeared to be leading the marchers. He rode into what looked like a mass of flying fists and caps. "Who's that on the horse?" asked Patrick. "That's one of the organisers. It looks as if he's trying to break up a fight." "Good luck to him. I'm not waiting around to get arrested." Patrick changed direction, pitting himself against the flow of marchers, his two friends close on his heels. Many of those taking part in the rally were of the same mind as Patrick and had already left the street. This helped to thin out the edges, making it easier for them to break free of the crowd. From the roof of a nearby building, a rock was thrown, catching Patrick on the side of the head, and he sank to his knees. Instantly, more missiles followed, and the men tried to shield themselves as they dragged their unconscious friend to the safety of a narrow laneway. "What's happened?" asked Patrick, coming round on the rain-soaked cobblestones.
"Some young blackguards on a rooftop are slinging rocks at the crowd. I have half a mind to go up there and knock their heads together," said one of the men.
"Best leave them to it. Anyone with an ounce of sense would be doing the same as ourselves and heading for home," Patrick replied.
The rain beat down for most of that cold December day, and by the time he arrived at his muddy street, Patrick was soaked to the skin and frozen to the bone.
"You'll catch your death. Get out of those wet clothes."
Catherine pulled a sodden cap from her husband's head, revealing a large gash on his temple.
"Now don't go fretting about it," Patrick winced as he touched the wound. "It looks worse than it is. I was only knocked out for a few seconds."
"Knocked out? I told you there would be trouble. There's always trouble at those rallies. Now look at the state of you. Will you never learn, Patrick Gallagher?"
As Catherine tended his cuts, placing a cold, wet flannel on a rapidly forming bump, Patrick told her about his eventful day.
"There were thousands there. As many as 10,000, I'll wager. I've never been in a crowd that big. I was excited and fearful all at the same time."
"It would have served you better to accompany your wife and children to Mass. This is what you get for your sins," chided Catherine.
"Well, I'll tell it in confession if it makes you feel any better. Did you keep me some food? Or am I to be sent to bed early without supper for my penance?"
Patrick gave his wife a mock frown. Catherine could never stay angry at her husband for long. she dished up a bowl of stew from a pot on the small stove that Patrick had salvaged from a derelict building. It had made all the difference to their tiny, damp home, helping to dry out the air. Opening the door to the only other room in the house, Catherine peered into the darkness. "I leave the door ajar. The children have been coughing all evening. I've given them some elixir, but we had best keep our voices low so as not to disturb their sleep, Patrick."
"It's living in these back-to-backs that has them sick so often.
We should move, Catherine. There are better houses not too far from here."
"The rents are too high. We would never be able to save a penny or buy decent food. No, we can't afford a better house unless you agree to me finding employment. The bit of sewing I get doesn't amount to much."
"What, and have your father say I cannot support his daughter? Never."
"Then will you please consider Maggie's offer of a place to stay?" asked Catherine.
"Have you lost your senses, woman? Do you think your father and myself could live in the same parish? He cannot stand the sight of me, and that was plain for all to see the last time he was over. Besides, I have work here.
Most days, at least."
Patrick was referring to James and Mary's last visit to see their newest grandchild, his 2-year-old daughter. She had been given her maternal grandmother's name, but was called Maisie by the family. "If you feel crowded in this house at present, it's soon to become even smaller. I'm with child again." Catherine delivered her news as if she was remarking on the wet day outside. Patrick spluttered on a mouthful of watery stew. Chapter 2
"Tell Maggie our good news," Mary said in a loud voice.
"Catherine is coming home, isn't that grand, Maggie?" said James.
Mary frowned at her husband.
"What he meant to say was Catherine and Patrick are coming home to stay. Isn't that great news? They are hoping to lodge with you for a wee while until Patrick has work got."
"My hearing isn't so bad. You have to shout every word at me."
"Of course they can stay here for as long as they care to."
Maggie glared at Mary before turning to her brother.
"Does that mean you've forgiven the poor lad for having the cheek to marry our daughter, James?"
There was no response, and Maggie huffed.
"I thought as much, seeing as you still haven't forgiven me for encouraging him."
"Ah, would you stop with your old nonsense? Sure, he put that behind him long ago, isn't that so?"
Mary shot a warning glance at James.
"Of course I have. What's done is done. I may not welcome him with open arms, but I'll not turn him away either."
"That's very considerate of you, James. I'm sure Patrick will be honoured by your half-hearted attempt to welcome him to the family."
James stood and fixed his cap firmly onto his head. His sister had always been able to get under his skin in a way that not even his wife had managed to do.
"Well, that's all he can expect, for now at least. Maybe he'll grow on me the longer he's here.
Does that cheer you up at all?"
James glared down at Maggie.
"Would you look at the face on that, Mary? Keep it away from your hens or they'll stop their laying. Even his beard is in a tizzy."
Both women laughed heartily as James's hand instinctively flew to his chin. He looked disparagingly at each of them before turning his back and heading out through the open door.
"The two of ye are as bad as each other, behaving like that," admonished Mary. "He'll be sour for the day."
"Ah, James doesn't harbour ill feelings for long, except where young Patrick Gallagher is concerned. It's a blessing they'll be living with me, and not under his nose in his own house. Mind you, they could be fishing together on the same boat."
"Have you considered that?" asked Maggie.
The thought had never seemed of much significance to Mary until that moment, and her face clouded over. She considered the situation before responding.
"James is not a foolish man. He knows better than to bring quarrels out to sea. But Patrick is younger and, I fear, somewhat excitable.
I might have a word with Matthew Clark. He's sure to keep an eye on the two of them," said Mary.
In the Gallagher home in Sunderland, Patrick dragged himself out of a warm bed, taking his clothes from under the blankets. Shivering in the cold air, he climbed into his shirt and trousers. Having been sourly all morning, refusing to attend mass with his wife and children, he left the chill of the bedroom to sit by the warm stove. The young man mulled over his family's situation. Things had been happening too fast for his liking. His eyes were drawn to the small window across the room, and Patrick watched as a beam of dust-filled sunlight forced its way inside. It washed over an old kitchen table and highlighted the one splash of colour in his dismal surroundings, a single flower in a jar of water. Catherine's eyes lit up every time he brought one home to her, and he never tired of her joyful reaction. Two steps towards the window had Patrick warming his back in the sunlight as his eyes scanned the opposite wall. A deep crack ran jaggedly down its centre. If the family had still been living in the house behind, they could have passed cups of tea to each other. The opening was that wide in places. Catherine had stuffed the draughty gap with old newspapers in an attempt to keep the heat in their own house. Patrick pulled open the door, allowing the warmth of a spring morning stream into the cottage. Breathing in a lungful of moist air, he stepped into the centre of the alley to survey the surrounding buildings. Of the 16 houses that only a few years before had been home to more than 80 people, 5 were lived in. Each building had an identical one attached directly to its back. They would soon be demolished and Patrick's family forced to leave anyway. Giving in to Catherine's pleadings to return to Ireland had made sense at the time, but the young man was beginning to regret that decision as the move to Blackrock drew nearer. The sound of his children's laughter could be heard before they even turned the corner into the alleyway, and Patrick couldn't help but smile. Catherine was carrying Maisie, and young Tom launched himself into his father's arms.
"Mummy has a surprise for you. Close your eyes and hold out your hand."
The little boy's eyes shone with delight. Patrick complied and felt something small and light being placed on his palm.
"You can look now, Daddy." "Is this all for me, Tom?" asked Patrick, licking his lips.
"It's only a wee cake," said Catherine. "We thought it might cheer you up."
"I think we can share it between us. Sure, it's no fun eating such a delicacy on your own, is it?"
The young father smiled at the whoops of joy from his children. Patrick's doubts about moving melted away at the look of contentment on his wife's face. He hoisted Tom onto his shoulders and suggested they have their picnic in the park. Catherine protested that Maisie was too heavy for her to carry any further.
"Give her here to me."
Patrick plucked his daughter from her mother's arms.
"Don't I carry much more than the weight of these two every day at the quarry?"
I suppose that's true. Sure, if I get tired of walking, a fine horse of a man like yourself would have no bother carrying the three of us home, would you?" teased Catherine.
"No bother at all. In fact, I'd be carrying 4 of ye. You're forgetting about one of the children, aren't you?"
Catherine's hands automatically went to her swollen abdomen.
"Right so, it's off to the park with us. We might as well get used to being surrounded by grass. It won't be such a shock for the children when we move them to Ireland," laughed Patrick.
Chapter 3. When Catherine saw her family standing on the quayside waving up at her, she cried with joy. Even her Aunt Maggie had turned up, sitting on the cart like Queen Victoria herself. The young couple stepped off the boat carrying a child each. Breege took hold of Maisie while Mary snatched her grandson from his father's tight grip. Hugs and kisses were exchanged while Patrick and James stood aloof, having shared a brief handshake.
"Look at her ladyship, sitting up there on her throne like the queen herself."
Catherine gave a little curtsy to her aunt.
"Myself and the king here are quite happy in each other's company. Isn't that so, Ree?"
Maggie called out to the donkey.
"It took me so long to climb up here,
I've no intention of repeating it for ye all to see and make fun of. Here, hand me up those poor wee mites before the life is squeezed out of them."
As Tom and Maisie were being lifted up to join their great-aunt, one of the ship's crew came over to Patrick and spoke to him. The young man nodded and pointed to the cart. James watched as the crewman walked away and wondered what his son-in-law was up to. Patrick could see him staring and skirted around the women who were still embracing each other, tears of joy glistening on their cheeks.
"I brought something over from England, but it's a wee bit heavy. Is it all right with you if we hoist it onto the cart?"
Patrick inquired of James.
"I see you've already made the arrangement with one of the crew, so you might as well get on with it. As long as it doesn't do any damage, mind," was James's blunt reply.
Patrick cringed inwardly at the tone of his father-in-law's voice. He silently berated himself for not speaking to him first about using his cart to transport the surprise he had organized for Catherine.
"I'm sorry, Maggie, you'll have to come down from your throne until we load something onto the cart. Here, let me help you."
The young man held his arms up to her.
"You're a gentleman, Patrick, and no doubt about it." Maggie shot her brother a dagger of a look.
Putting her hands on the broad, muscular shoulders of the ex-quarryman, the older woman was taken aback at the change in him.
"I do declare, Patrick Gallagher, you've turned into a fine figure of a man," Maggie said, pinching his arms.
The young father's face coloured as he lifted his children down from the cart and handed them to Mary and Breege, before leading the donkey further along the quayside. He saw where the winch for lifting the cargo was positioned on the boat and placed the cart where one of the crew had directed. When Patrick looked back at his family, he was amused by the confused look on their faces and beckoned to Catherine.
"What are you up to now?" she asked when she reached him.
Patrick stood her in front of him, facing the cart, and told her to close her eyes.
"On no account are you to open them, no matter what sounds you hear. I have a surprise for you,"
Patrick said as he steadied the donkey.
"What manner of surprise is it that you have need of a cart?"
Catherine looked back at her children and laughed.
"I think your da has brought an elephant with him, all the way from England," she called out. "Put your hands over your eyes, Catherine. No peeking, do you hear?" said Patrick.
Doing as she was told, the young wife felt foolish standing by the cart with her eyes shut tight and her family watching, along with a few other spectators. She heard the squeal of the pulleys as the ropes strained with the weight of their burden and then a soft thud amid the creaking of wood. The donkey tried to move forward as the cart took the load, and the sound of his hooves stamping on the ground almost made Catherine open her eyes.
"You can look now," she heard Patrick say.
The sight of her old stove perched on top of the cart made her screech with delight as she threw herself into the young man's arms. Her heart swelled with joy at the love Patrick must have had for her to go to all that trouble.
"You are the best husband any woman could wish for, Patrick Gallagher." "Ah, sure, I was only thinking of myself. Now you have no excuse not to make me a fine meal, have you?"
Patrick teased.
Chapter 4
Catherine had just finished reading her brother's most recent letter from America when her father stepped through the door. James saw the sheets of paper in her hand and smiled.
"I see your Aunt Maggie has you reading that rubbish about women voting.
Thomas should know better than to encourage her with stories of such lunacy," he said.
"Stories of courage and determination, you mean? What's her name? Susan, is it?" asked Maggie.
"Susan B. Anthony. A name to be remembered. Is that not so, Aunt Maggie?" responded Catherine. The older woman smacked her hand off her knee and laughed.
"Our Thomas is a grand fellow altogether." Maggie shook a finger at James.
"The young men of today know where their loyalty should lie, and that woman, Susan B. Anthony,
deserves all the support she can get.
Imagine having the nerve to cast a vote in an election, knowing she was breaking the law, and then stand up in court as proud as punch about it.
Mark my words, if women get the vote in America, it won't be long before we have it here.
And who would you be voting for, if you could, Aunt Maggie? Asked Catherine.
Oh, for heaven's sake, don't encourage her, said James.
I came over to give Patrick a message from the Murphy brothers. They're short of a man for their boat this evening, if he's interested.
He should take the opportunity now while there's a break in the weather.
I can't go myself. Make sure he lets them know whether or not he'll be joining them. I'm off now before my lunatic of a sister starts on another one of her rants.
As James left the house, he could hear Maggie extolling the virtues of a local politician, and he couldn't help but smile. His sister had become even more vocal as she got older, and her talk of suffrage and equal rights for women did more to amuse the neighbours than influence them. When Patrick arrived home, Catherine took great pleasure in telling him of the offer of a place on a boat for the evening. The smile that came to his face every time the opportunity of joining a crew came along assured her she had done the right thing in dragging him home to Ireland. Her young husband was a likable man, and offers of work regularly came his way, whether it was labouring in the fields or other such casual employment. People did not forget Patrick Gallagher once they had met him, and his name would spring to mind whenever help was needed. Some of the jobs he was landed with made Patrick wish he hadn't been remembered so easily. However, being part of a crew on one of the Black Rock boats was not one of them.
"Will your dad be going out too? He usually fishes with the Murphy brothers, doesn't he?" asked Patrick.
"He can't go this evening."
"Be patient with him, love. This is his way of showing us he's beginning to accept you as family," said Catherine.
"He's just making sure his daughter and grandchildren are fed. That's what he's doing."
"Aye, you're not wrong, Patrick.
My brother is as stubborn as an old goat. But you've been well and truly accepted by the rest of us, so don't fret over it, lad. He'll warm to you in time," said Maggie. "Is that not so, Ellen?"
Patrick smiled at the latest member of his young family as she gurgled and wriggled at her belly being tickled.
"With the weather ruining most of the crops this year, there'll be little or no work in the harvesting. I'm thinking of going back to England for a while. I've 3 children to provide for now, and milk won't satisfy our Ellen for much longer," said Patrick.
As Catherine put a platter of potatoes on the table, she patted her husband's shoulder. She knew he was right about her father's reason for passing the job on to his son-in-law.
"Ah, well, sure, don't let it spoil the evening for you. Once you get out there in the bay, you'll forget all about my father and his sulking, and about going to England."
After their meal, Patrick sat his children on his lap and told them stories of old Irish myths. They especially loved his tales of the sea, and young Tom would always ask his father to buy his own boat and take him out in it. Each time, Patrick would assure his son that he was saving every farthing for that very day, and by the time he was finished school, they would be fishing together. Once Catherine had settled the children into bed, she joined Patrick and Maggie at the fireside. Sitting on his knee, she remarked on how calm the weather had been of late and hoped it didn't mean a storm was on the way.
"At the first sign of bad weather, the boats will turn back. They always do, even when I, myself, wish they would stay a bit longer and take a chance. Maybe it's as well I don't have my own boat. You might find yourself widowed."
Catherine frowned and punched him lightly on the shoulder.
"Patrick Gallagher, don't you dare tempt fate with that sort of talk. It's because you can swim that you're not afraid. There's nothing like the fear of drowning to make a man respect the sea and the weather."
Chapter 5. For once, it was Patrick who wanted to turn back to shore. The rest of the boats were already doing so due to a squall that had suddenly come up upon them,
but a net full of fish was hard to leave behind. The Murphy brothers put it to a vote as to whether or not they should cut their losses and head for home. Patrick had been the only one of the four men voting to leave the catch behind. While three of them struggled to haul in the net, the youngest crewman bailed water out of the boat as fast as it was coming in. The heavy load dragged the vessel sideways in the swelling sea, while an ever-increasing gale sent waves crashing over the men. "We'll have to cut the net free and turn back, or we'll lose the boat," shouted Patrick above the screeching of the wind, "and our lives!" Waving his bone-handled knife in the air, Patrick waited for a signal from one of the Murphys that would allow him to free the boat from a heavy weight threatening to drag them all to a watery grave. The older brother took out his own knife and shouted for Patrick to cut through the ropes. It wasn't long before their burden was released, sinking below the waves. While Patrick helped the youngest member to bail water, the others rowed with all their might. As they drew closer to the shore, the sea began to calm a little. Patrick had removed his boots earlier, tying them securely to the boat. He knew he would have a better chance of staying afloat without them, should he be washed overboard. A crowd had gathered on the beach, watching and praying for the men to reach the shore, and hopes were high that soon they would be on dry land. The men on the boat had begun to offer their own silent prayer of thanks when, out of nowhere, a monstrous wave reared up and flipped them over. James McGruther and Matthew Clark were already in a boat, preparing to set out for a rescue should it be necessary. As soon as the giant swell struck, they began to row furiously in the direction of the upturned boat. The sea was choppy, but most of the wind had died down. James, who sat in the bow, glanced over his shoulder from time to time, trying to count how many heads were in the water. He could only see one person, and they seemed to be hanging onto the upturned boat. As they pulled up alongside the vessel, the youngest member of the crew cried out for help, and the two rescuers hauled him in beside them. While James questioned him about the other fishermen, his eyes scanned the sea around him. Matthew Clark tied the upturned vessel to his own boat, as he too kept an eye out for the missing crew.
"Patrick pulled me up out of the water. Then he went down to look for the Murphy boys. He should be back up by now. Can either of you see him?"
the young man asked in between bouts of coughing up seawater from his lungs.
"Over there, James," Matthew Clark shouted, grabbing hold of his oars.
"I see him, I see him," said James. They rowed towards the exhausted young man who had just come up for air. Patrick had seen their approach but was frantically looking around him in the hopes of finding at least one of the Murphy brothers. Just as he was getting ready to dive once more, his father-in-law's voice rang out.
"Patrick Gallagher, think of your wife and children. The Murphys are gone. Get yourself into this boat and don't be foolish, man."
Ignoring the advice, Patrick disappeared below the surface and searched until he could no longer hold his breath. His ears began to ring and bright colours flashed before his eyes. As a feeling of serenity and calmness overtook him, Patrick slowly lost consciousness. Chapter 6.
"Da, is it Patrick? Tell me you have him in the boat. Da!"
The crowd waiting on the beach parted and hands began to pull Catherine through the gap, causing her to stumble.
"Let her through, it's his wife,"
someone shouted. The words were like music to her ears at first, confirming that it was indeed Patrick, until the thought struck her that her young husband may not be alive. Was it his lifeless body that had been pulled from the sea? As James and Matthew carried the unconscious fisherman towards a cart that was waiting by the roadside, Catherine grabbed Patrick's limp arm and shook it, crying out for him to wake up. Mary came running up from behind and took her daughter by the shoulders, holding her back.
"They're bringing him to Dr. Brunker's, Catherine. Leave him be, my love. Every second counts."
"Oh, Ma, I don't think he was breathing. I didn't see his chest.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?